This is tape number one of the morning of February the 2nd, 1961, the President, Noyce Hillman Press. Mr. President, what we'd like to do is to get the sort of cameos, quick sketches of all the presidents, right down the line from Woodrow Wilson down, going from Woodrow Wilson now to the next president. Just in a few lines, your description and estimate of him.
Well, you start with if you have any unfinished thoughts about Wilson, fine. Otherwise, let's go right on to the career of Harding.
Well, Wilson was a great president. He had his troubles, and he had difficulties. But I think when history's written, he'd be one of the five or six great presidents.
Well, you're writing it now, and you say he's one of the great ones.
Yes, I do.
You're entitled to that opinion, and that opinion stands. Now, when you get to Harding, how do you rate him?
Well, Harding was a man who didn't really understand the responsibilities with which he was faced. And I don't like to make detrimental remarks about a man who's been president of the United States, but he never did know what the presidency was all about.
And his tenure in the United States Senate, and he was a publisher of a newspaper, didn't give him any insight into it at all.
Evidently not. No, it didn't.
Well, then, what was he elected for?
Well, he was elected to follow a great president. And when men are elected to follow a great president, the people think maybe they'll have some relief from the troubles they have to go through with when a great president is in office. And I think that's the principal reason he was elected.
He gave us normalcy then.
That's what he called it, but that didn't mean a thing. It meant to go back instead of forward.
And as a people, as a nation, we then became what? An isolationist nation.
Well, yes. The evident attempt was made to discredit what Wilson had done in arranging a League of Nations. And while Harding, in his preliminary address, said that he was for the League of Nations, he did everything he could to break it up.
You wouldn't want to comment just a little bit on the Teapot Dome and the scandals of the Harding administration?
No, because they speak for themselves.
Mr. President, do you think that he might have been more alert and avoided some of those scandals? How much blame can you assess him for?
Well, I don't want to assess any blame for him, but his lack of knowledge on what had gone before was the cause of his principal troubles. And that's the troubles of any president who goes in without a background of the history of the United States.
By lack of knowledge in this instance, you mean lack of knowledge of the power that individuals have in with the resources of the country?
No, the lack of knowledge of the history that went before him. And the lack of knowledge on the ability to use the powers which he had as president.
Well, then it was lack of knowledge, lack of capacity, and lack of interest, too?
Well, you can translate it any way you want. Of course, he wasn't interested in anything but to set the country back to what it had been before World War II, World War I.
No damage, no lasting damage left as a result of his presidency, was it?
I hope not.
All right, then that will conclude with Harding, and let's go on to his successor who took over when he died in office, Coolidge.
Coolidge was a character in his own right, but his idea was exactly in the same line with the ideas of the president who had just left office. He believed that the less a president did, the better it was for the country. And I don't agree with him, but then he sat with his feet in his desk drawer and did nothing. And that's what happened in the Eisenhower administration.
So we had from Harding to Coolidge both his first unfinished term and his full term, no action of any kind.
That's right. He just sat there and signed bills when they came up and vetoed some that were against his principles, and then that's all there was to it.
Period of relaxation. You were discussing the
Coolidge
and his period.
Well, Coolidge didn't think that the president ought to in any way interfere with the policies of the legislative branch. And yet, the president is the man who makes policy for the whole country.
Well, Coolidge did gain a certain amount of esteem among the people because of his whimsical character and his jokes, didn't he? I understand you're quite an authority.
Well, yes.
Story of the
that, that's true. And his entrance into national politics was his decision that the police strike in Boston was against the government, and they couldn't do it, and that's what set him up to the whole thing.
Do you remember any story of his that's very characteristic of him so far as presidency?
Well, yes, there are a lot of good stories about him. There's one in particular that I always remembered about his friend from Massachusetts staying all night at the White House, and this friend got up and had breakfast with Mrs. Coolidge and told her that he was a collector of cigar man. And she told him to go on over and ask Coolidge for a cigar man, he'd give it to him. Coolidge always went over early to look through the mail and be sure that he knew everything that was going on. And when this fellow arrived, he told the president what he wanted. The president took out his cigar box, took a band off one of his cigars, and handed the fellow, and that's all there was to it. He didn't give him a cigar. And then there's another good story about him. When one of his friends, while he was governor, came in to see him in Massachusetts, and he was governor in Boston, and they sat and talked a while, and Coolidge asked him if he'd have a drink. He said he would. So Coolidge got out a couple of glasses and a bottle and poured a drink for both of them, and they had it. And they sat there talking after Coolidge put the bottle and the glasses away, and pretty soon another member of the Massachusetts court, they called it, I think, came in, and the first fellow who come in told the governor that he thought his friend would like to have a drink. Well, Coolidge got out a glass and a bottle and poured him a drink. And the second fellow who was having the drink said, "Does my friend want a drink?" Coolidge said, "No, he's had one." Those are all friendly stories.
You have one about the Washington Monument. Could you tell that one again?
Yes, when what is the name of the fellow who wrote the book debunking Washington?
Look that up.
Yeah, we'll look it up.
We'll look it up.
Not Lewis, somebody like it.
No, I'll tell you what his name was, Director. Well, anyway, somebody came in and told Coolidge that this fellow had debunked Washington. He turned around and looked out the window. Well, he says his monument is still there.
Well, Mr. President, this stand which Coolidge took on the police strike, saying that no one had a right to strike against the government at any time, anywhere.
That's correct.
You think that
when a man takes the oath to support and defend the government of the United States, that's his first loyalty. No union or anything else can have anything to do with it.
You don't think that any men engaged in civil service or public protection have any right to strike against?
No, I don't. I don't think anybody's got a right to strike against the government.
Local or federal?
Federal or anywhere else.
The President says anyone who's taken the oath to support the government has no right to strike.
And every one of these people you talk about have taken that oath.
The oath.
You mean policemen, firemen, are those people who are
anyone,
sworn in?
Anybody else. They're making them too. They're civil service or anybody else. They've sworn to protect and defend the government of the United States. And that's what they have to do. They have no other lawyers.
How do they get protected? Doesn't that pretty well put them in a position where they can't protect their interests?
No, that's not true, because they have congressional representation that will protect their interests.
In that sense, then, the Coolidge was a sound force.
No question about that. His beginning was as sound as it could be.
He expressed something that the rest of the nation approved of.
Oh, yes.
In addition to his own state of Massachusetts.
That's the reason they put him on the ticket.
Proved to be a man of strength, but
he didn't necessarily prove to be a man of strength. He proved to be a man who met an opportunity when it appeared.
In other words, he expressed the sentiment, the proper sentiment at the right time.
That's right.
He went from lieutenant governor to vice president. Was that the way it was?
No, he was elected governor.
Governor.
He became governor.
Governor.
His police thing he did, I think, when
he elected governor, and he was elected governor, and then he was elected vice president. And he was sworn in up in Vermont by his father, who was a justice of the peace.
He had a certain homespun philosophy which he felt that nobody should do too much so far as the federal government is concerned.
Well, I think he had that idea, but when it came to the point where things had to be done, I think if he had been forced to do it, he would have. But he never was forced to do it while he was president.
So he more or less relaxed in the office of president and engaged in nothing.
That's right, just like our Mr. Eisenhower did.
All right, so
and
we'll
like
get,
General Grant did.
We'll get to him presently. Now that is enough for Coolidge. Could we then get to his successor? Hoover, but would you comment on his fuzzy point about not wanting to run again? I do not choose to run.
Well, Coolidge made that statement up in South Dakota when he was up there on vacation, and I think he was always sorry that he made it, because he liked to live at the White House. But when he made that statement, all his own party were perfectly willing to take him at what he said, and that's the reason he wasn't renominated. And he always called his successor, Mr. Hoover, the great engineer. And I was always very fond of Mr. Hoover, because he inherited a situation that had been developing since 1921, when Harding became president. And the difficulty was not possible to be met. I think Mr. Hoover did the best he possibly could. And I've always been a friend and very fond of Mr. Hoover.
But you saw differently in point of
view. Of course, we had a different viewpoint on policy, and it was our own business, but we never made personal matters out of it. We were always friendly.
This is the end of tape one, the morning of February the 2nd. This is tape two, the morning of February the 2nd. Mr. President, in commenting on Hoover, you make an important historical reference, or rather an observation, in which you say that after all, some of the troubles which he faced were troubles which were developing in previous administrations, which
there's
is very much what you think.
There isn't any question about that. These things all developed, beginning with the Harding administration. And I'll say this, that President Hoover did the very best he could to try to straighten them out. But under the conditions with which he was faced, it was almost impossible to get them straightened out.
Well, found him trying to adopt measures to stave off disaster, but they were either inadequate or too late.
Well, they were inadequate for the reason that he was of the opinion that the president couldn't take positive action to get things done. His successor did that, and that's what brought things out of the Kinks.
Well, you have on several occasions delineated your belief that quite often a president may face a situation not necessarily of his own making, but which he inherits from previous administration or administrations.
That's true.
And you think, yeah, that was the case in the...
I don't think so, in doubt about that.
Well, in a sense, every president inherits all the past.
He can't help that. He does, and there's nothing to do about it.
But the point you make...
But he must find out what he's inherited and then see if he can meet the situation.
In other words, it's very important for him to assess what he faces in a realistic way.
That's right.
The fact that a lot of conditions developed under previous administrations does not absolve, historically, the man who takes the presidency. He's got to act on his own.
No, yes, that's right. He has to act in a manner that he thinks will help the country. And I think you find most presidents tried to do that, but sometimes they were not successful.
But, David, then the question of absolving, what I'm trying to get at is that quite often a president may have a program that he may not, that he may find is inadequate because he hasn't properly assessed what he has inherited. The point that the president here is now making, that he has to assess and appraise realistically what he faces.
Yeah, but I think the point that the president is making is that this president, whoever he is, has to act, and he has to utilize the full powers of the president.
That's understandable, but he's saying also he has to appraise. So I'm trying to get to the question. Do you think that Hoover appraised the situation accurately?
Hoover appraised the situation as nearly accurately as he could with his background and experience. You see, he had been out of the country for quite a while. He'd been the man who fed the starving under Woodrow Wilson, and he had been, previous to that, he made a fortune in foreign countries, and he had been Secretary of Commerce in the cabinets of Harding and Coolidge, and it is my opinion that his viewpoint did not start at the grassroots. I think he did the very best he could while he was President of the United States, but his viewpoint was that the President was the executive to enforce the laws, and he had nothing to do with making them, with which I don't agree, of course. But that made no difference in our friendship.
No, you feel that he was an honorable, able man, but politically he had the wrong kind of conditioning for the president.
Well, I think he was an honorable, straightforward person. And when he was feeding the people around the world, he did it for the welfare and benefit of the people whom he was feeding. And I don't think that he had any idea but the welfare of the country, of the United States at heart.
Well, then his administration was blamed for a great many things, in your judgment, that were not directly his responsibility.
That's correct. There were things that had come on since Woodrow Wilson went out of office in 1921.
Would it be fair just to make a final comparison that had he been either in the Harding or the Coolidge period, he would have been a more distinctive, he would have done a more distinctive job.
You can't tell.
Can't tell.
You
all right, I just
tell.
Wanted to prove that.
You can't tell.
All right, then we sign that off as the end of a very curious era in the United States, and everything suddenly went to pot, and we found ourselves a penniless nation, so to speak, at the end of the...
I don't think we were penniless. I think the people thought they were penniless, but when the facts really came to the top, they were not penniless and never would be.
Let me ask you something personal here. Do you approve of the way in which the transition between Hoover and FDR took place.
No, I don't. I think there ought to have been more help and consideration when FDR took over. But the campaign had been so rough, and so many things had been charged against Hoover, that Roosevelt didn't treat him with the courtesy that he should have.
Should he have joined him in the closing of the banks when Hoover asked him for it?
Yes, because he finally had to close them himself.
And you think it would have been better if Roosevelt had agreed to doing it with Hoover?
Yes, I do.
And that delay, of course, accumulated a little more trouble, didn't it?
Yes, but not serious trouble, but it just as well have been done then as when it was done. That's the argument I made.
Wasn't there a curious contradiction in the Hoover policy of fostering the Reconstruction Finance Corporation against a generally conservative attitude on the part of his administration?
Well, when Hoover found the necessity for an organization like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, he didn't hesitate to organize it. And it was a great asset, not only in the latter days of the Hoover administration, but was used up until my own administration, 12 years later.
All right, we now come to the Roosevelt administration, on which you may be reluctant to comment broadly, but how do you define the coming of the Roosevelt administration historically?
Well, we were in the midst of an emergency. People were worried about what was going to happen to the country. And when Roosevelt took over, he made a strong approach to the situation and met it straight through with the necessary legislative program that made the country start on the road to recovery, which didn't happen for about 10 or 12 years.
And you think this was one of the most brilliant moments in the history of the Republic, the coming of Roosevelt?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think Roosevelt was a great president. I think he did a great job. And history will say that, I'm sure.
What he did was totally unprecedented and completely...
No, it wasn't unprecedented. It had been done before. It had been done when Lincoln took over in 1861. And it had been done previous to that, when Andrew Jackson took over after Adams, John Quincy Adams.
What about the personality of Mr. Roosevelt, Mr. President?
Well, I liked him. He was a very, very pleasant person to me. And he had a personality that would take people into camp. And for that reason, I was very fond of him. But I was always of the opinion that he ought to have restraints, as any president ought to have.
You develop that a little, Mr. President.
Well, it's hard to do.
What what branch of the government, sir?
Well, the Congress and the courts. And they acted on that basis. And of course, he had his troubles, as every president ought to have. And when he got to the point where he wanted to go too far, why, these checks and balances, which he had in our government, took care of the situation.
Where do you think he wanted to go too far, in what areas?
Well, he wanted to be in a position where he could say yes and no to everything, and that can't happen in our government.
And you don't think it should happen?
No, I don't. No, I never have.
Well, what happens if the Congress and the Supreme Court don't go along, as some of them did?
Well, the same thing happens that happened under his administration. They had to take a new start after they turned him down. And after the people turned him down in his campaign in 1938, when he was trying to send congressmen and senators back home, which he had no right to do at all.
Well, in his unprecedented four terms, it was natural for him to feel that the majority of the people were constantly backing him, although the majority dwindled each election, didn't
it? Well, they were. They were backing him because we had an emergency, which had to be met, and they were afraid they wouldn't find a man to meet it. And that happens whenever a strong president is in office. But we finally met it. All right.
How did you personally feel about the third term?
I was against it. Always had been. I never thought that the precedent should have been broken. And I think the precedent should have stood. But I'm strongly against the Constitution Amendment, the 22nd Amendment, which prohibits the president from succeeding himself for the simple reason that the president is like any other executive when his plans are limited by constitutional or legislative amendment. He's in a bad way. And I think the 22nd Amendment is just as bad an amendment as the 18th. And I've testified to that in the Congress of the United States, in the House of Representatives, and there's a record on it.
What do you think led him to accept or consider a third term?
The situation in the world, which he thought had to be met by somebody who had been continually familiar with what was going on. There wasn't anything wrong with that.
Because, you know, Mr. President, he had already signed a contract to be the chief roving editor of Collier's magazine.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, he did, Mr. President.
I don't think he'd have made a good one.
But at any rate, this was to, he was to become the roving editor immediately at the conclusion of his second term. And the document was a legal document, so he had every intention of going through with it. But something must have happened which made him consider going on.
Well, the thing that happened was that he was anxious to win the Second World War. That's all it was. That's all he had in mind, I'm sure.
Well, this was before the World War, but he... You
know, this had to be in the middle of the Second World War, Bill, because he wasn't reelected the third time until 1940. And I was elected senator at the same time he was elected president.
This is before our involvement in it,
yes.
But the war was on.
That's right, the war was on.
But he was already committed personally to...
He was already committed to Churchill and a free world to try to save it, and that's what the trouble was.
This is the end of tape 2, February the 2nd, morning of February 2nd, 1961.